Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 82, Bionic Brain Symbionts, the next phase of human slurry.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today is June 24th, so it's this, you know, pretty much very early summer here, and it's the first episode of our sixth year of doing Futures in Biotech. So to bring it down a notch in terms of lightness here, we're not going into someone's lab. I decided to bring a panel together, and we have Dr. Justin Sanchez. And Andre Nantel and myself, we're going to talk about some scientific stories that we think are really interesting this summer. So, hey, there's Justin. How are you doing, Justin?
I'm doing great. Glad to be on the panel. It's been a long time since I've done one of these.
I think it's been almost 2 years since you've been on the show. And for those who don't know Justin, he is the director of the Neuroprosthetics Group, Research Group, sorry, Associate Professor, Department of Biomedical Engineering at the University of Miami. And he's got a lot of scientific posters there. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
And we're trying to pull Andre onto the line, and he's having some video issues with a new Skype upgrade. But we'll get him on in a second. So, of the stories that we'd like to talk about today, I want to talk about some recent work that has been done with cystic fibrosis. An autoantigen technology that allows us to determine how to identify. So there's autoimmune diseases where your body's antibodies can't recognize between self and non-self, and they start attacking your cells and causing neurological disorders, for example. There's a new technique to identify what proteins your autoantibodies, your own immune system, is messing up and attacking. That hasn't been, it's been very, very difficult to do up till now. We're going to talk a little bit about a global quantification of mammalian gene expression control. Andre's going to present that story, and we're going to talk about Justin's story. A paper that Justin recently published in March, which is just reading the title, a symbiotic brain-machine interface through value-based decision-making. The idea of a symbiotic brain machine, just, I thought, was absolutely crazy and wild. And so while we're trying to get Andre, why don't I talk about the cystic fibrosis story first, and we'll break the ice with that. Is that okay? Are you there, Justin?
I'm here. Go for it.
All right. Cool. So, in the news, right? I'll take it a step back here. CF, cystic fibrosis, is a disease where patients develop thick mucus in their lungs, and this thick mucus leads to infection, and it leads to like inflammatory response, and the median lifespan right now is 37 years, right? And there's about 70,000 people in the U.S. and Europe that have the genetic disorder. 22 years ago, there was a paper published on the gene. So it became understood, the molecular pathology of the disease, 22 years ago, at least a large chunk of it. But yet, still today, there's been no therapeutics that have hit the market that have been effective at curing the disease. The only thing patients can do is manage the symptoms, right? And this is the era of biotech where you can understand exactly what's going on, but yet there's been no cure. So this has been a very, very tough challenge, and it just illustrates how difficult it is that even though you understand a genetic disorder, how hard it is to fix it. But Vertex in Boston has managed to get a compound past two phase three clinical trials. Let me explain a little bit about the context of their work, right? Vertex, about 10 years ago, acquired Aurora Biosciences for $592 million. And this gave them the technology to develop compounds that could modify CFTR or create CFTR modulators. Now, cystic fibrosis is a disease where there's a mutation in a protein called a cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. It's a chloride channel. It's a selective chloride channel that allows chloride to get across the epithelium. Epithelium is the lining. It's your skin. It's the lining of your lungs, the lining of your nasal passages. It's basically the tissue that is exposed to the outside or quote unquote the inside of your body. It's very important to have a chloride channel there to balance ionic potential. There are two kinds of mutations. One, the most common, is called the Delta F508. So it's a phenylalanine deletion mutation. And the protein can't traffic to the cell surface. Okay, it's the protein, the RNA is translated to protein into peptides. The peptides fold. But as they get trafficked to the surface, they get returned and degraded. That's the most common mutation. There's another mutation, a form of mutation, where you have a loss of function of the channel. It's made, it's trafficked, but there's it has an altered function, right? So you've got a chloride channel there, but if you could just get it to work, you now have improved the outcome of the patient. So this first molecule is called, these are really hard to pronounce. Ivacaftor. I don't know how they named it, but so it's a molecule that modulates the activity of that second form of mutation where the protein actually gets to the cell surface but it doesn't work. So what this does is it can improve the activity, the chloride activity. The only problem is that only affects 4% of the 70,000 patients, right? But it's the first time somebody's been able to get a modulator to have an improved outcome. A little bit about this mutation. It's the glycine 551 to aspartic acid mutation. It's a mutation in the nucleotide binding site. So these chloride channels bind ATP and then release ATP or ADP. And people with this mutation can't, their CFTR channel doesn't bind ATP very well. So it has weak activity. So this drug, Ivacaftor, improves channel activity. And they did two phase three clinical trials, 161 patients from ages 12 and up and 52 patients from six to 11. And they tested them for forced expiratory volume, expiratory volume in 1 second. So FEV1, as they call it. They had an improved lung function by 10.5%, right? And this can translate to an extension of 5 years. So I think this is a really worthy story in that it demonstrates after 22 years of effort, an investment of $592 million on the part of Vertex. The CFF, or the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, has put in a considerable amount of resources as well, and they've recently put in $75 million into the Vertex effort, and also $25 million to other groups to tackle this. And now there's proof of concept that a drug can get to past clinical trials and soon translate to the market and extend CF patients. So this is a tremendous story of molecular medicine and tackling a genetic disorder. Vertex's next step is they have some molecules. There's one called Lumacador. I can't pronounce it. Lumacator. So that actually can, for the large population that have the Delta F508 mutation, the one that doesn't traffic to the surface, this can bind to the CFTR channel and cause it to traffic. So now you're going to have they're going into a phase two combination clinical trial where they add the molecule that can potentiate the activity and one that can cause it to restore trafficking to improve potential outcome. And the goal is to really improve the activity by 50%, which would probably be the threshold you need to restore full chloride channel activity or a functional chloride channel to a point where there would be no deficit in lifespan. I think this is a tremendous story and worth following up on. As a small biotech company myself, here in Cleveland, we've put in about $3.5 million to develop some molecules for brain swelling. And I'm wondering if it took Vertex $592 million to acquire a company to do screening. That's just a start. Am I up against an impossible challenge? I don't think so. I think we're thinking our way through some of the more difficult challenges and things are working out. But boy, if I had that kind of resource, it'd be really neat. So why don't I leave that story. I'll put a link in the show notes to... for those that want to follow up and find out more about the cystic fibrosis, the latest breakthrough in cystic fibrosis work. Is Andre on the line yet?
I think so.
Awesome. Awesome.
I don't have video, though.
Oh, well, we do. Is there a photo of you on the internet?
that might be a bad idea.
So we've had some technical difficulties, in part because there's been a breakdown of the studio in Petaluma to move the technology across town to the brick house. And we're using a more conventional analog methodologies and a new version of Skype. This hasn't been too, effective. So we finally got Andre Nontel on the line. He's a senior research officer at the BRI, the Biotechnology Research Institute, Microarray Lab, National Research Council of Canada in Montreal. Welcome, Andre.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Oh man, it's good to have you. It's like that next story I already described the cystic fibrosis story and the discovery of a molecule that's gone past phase three clinical trials for CF patients. But the next story, the autoantigen discovery with the synthetic peptidome, I don't want to do without having you drill me with questions, because that's going to help get the story across. If I just say it, tell the story, it's going to be pretty thick. So we've got that story, we've got Andre's story, and we have Justin on the line with one of his papers that he wants to that I've asked him to present. So how about we, Andre, do you want to warm up slowly and we'll have Justin present his paper, then go on to the genetics?
I fully agree, because 2 minutes before coming online, I was still cleaning up my basement and suddenly I went like, oh, it's 5 to 4. Oh, God, I'm supposed to be on Twit now. So, yeah, right. Giving me a few minutes to catch up and get my brain back into science mode as we're spending 2 hours in the most disgusting room of my house would be just awesome.
All right, cool. Well, before we start, though, bon Saint-Jean, Andre.
Merci beaucoup. It's right. Rainy, cold, and windy, so it's perfect. This is going to be the day where the greatest number of houses in the province of Quebec are going to be immaculately clean, because everything is closed and weather sucks, so everybody's staying home, and so we might as well clean the house and do video games.
A lot of newborns next March. There's going to be this.
Not for me.
Your kids are almost in college, if not in college. All right.
Darren.
So Justin, perhaps you could present your symbiotic brain-machine interface through value-based decision-making. And by the way, we're going to interrupt you with a million questions. So okay. Definitely.
Perfect. I love questions.
All right.
But since it's a Friday and we're talking science, let's kind of take a step back a little bit and start thinking about things and maybe even dreaming a little bit. So so this paper that just came out, the concept for it really started a long time ago. And we were very intrigued with the idea of how both young kids learn to do certain things, you know, learn to perform motor tasks and things like that throughout their childhood. And we're also very intrigued by the idea of how animals and humans have learned to survive in their environments through the concept of reinforcement learning, meaning that as they perform behaviors while interacting with the environment, there are certain behaviors that lead them to things that they want, and there are certain behaviors that lead them to things that they don't want, right? And the brains of both humans and animals have adapted very nicely to reward, you know, both chemically and electrophysiologically, the kinds of things that are really good for your survival, right? And you know, these kinds of concepts have been studied for many, many years in the psychology circles and neuroscience circles. And we started asking the question: is could we bring in those concepts of reward and reinforcement into our interaction with computers and devices and prosthetics and things of this nature? So basically merging the biological systems with artificial systems, but through that concept of reinforcement learning. And you know, we can start to ask, you know, why would that be important? Why would that be interesting to us? And to put it very simply, is if that device, right, this electronic device, could share with you your brain's representation of things that are rewarding or reinforcing, it may be able to enable you to do things that are much more powerful, right? It could potentially learn with you as you are trying to control this device. And you know, I explain this to people in a very simple way. I say, just think if your computer had some idea of what your goals were, right? Then it could, in essence, assist you in achieving some of those goals, right? Right now, when we interact with computers, they're all completely input driven, right? We just give them commands and they execute those commands. And we are thinking in a way now that we can interact with a computer or a device in a much more rich way by sharing in these kind of goal kind of signals. And so that's what we set out to do. And
that's scary. Wait a minute. Is this legal? Because here I'm thinking. So you're, let me see if I understand this correctly. You're going to develop a device. You've got a device that, while you interact with your environment, is going to reinforce the positive signals that your brain typically generates during a successful outcome with the environment. Is that, well, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Right.
So, for example, if I eat a piece of chocolate and it's really good, my body says, wow, this is great.
Bring out a flow of serotonin every time you see Sarah Palin.
that's more of a leap. Anyway, that's so
evil usage.
Evil usage. Well, I don't know. She's got some appeal. yeah, she's interesting. But it's easier to say from north of the border. Let me just say that. when you're down here, it's kind of so. If you eat a piece of chocolate, or you go out into the bright sun on a 72 degree day, or you go for a swim on a hot day, your brain releases a bunch of responses, and you're trying to capture those responses similar to that, so that when you're trying to do something difficult with a brain-machine interface, trying to train your brain to use that interface, which may be close to impossible, very difficult, that it's going to talk back to you and say that you're doing it correctly?
Yeah, so it's essentially merging together your motor intent, right? Your intent to do physical kinds of things with those internal reward signals that are in your brain. And the idea is really to send both of those pieces of information to whatever device that you're trying to control, and that through analyzing that information in real time while you're interacting with it, that you could potentially do something much more sophisticated than without that kind of information. Right?
Would it speed up the learning?
Well, this one thing that we have, you know, thought about, and we haven't exactly tested this yet, but yes, right? Let's say your environment changes or your brain representation of the environment changes. If you have access to those reinforcing kind of signals, one may be able to speed up or respond more efficiently to those kinds of changes, right?
So how do you test that?
Yes, so very interesting question. we're doing two things. So we're doing both animal and human kind of research, where we record from both the motor part of the brain and the reward centers of the brain. And then we are developing sophisticated algorithms, computational kinds of models that can translate that activity into control commands for devices. And we can put those control modules under a variety of different conditions and test whether things adapt faster or adapt slower, or how they respond to perturbations. So one of the key issues that one has to develop if you want to do this is you have to construct what is called a closed loop neural interface. So the user and this device that is taking in the motor and reward signals have to both be working together simultaneously in closed loop. And it's through that continuous reaction through which you can observe the changes and really see the outcomes over time.
And, could you describe the devices so that we can sort of visualize it?
Yeah, so the general concept for building these first involves putting an implant into the brain, so some kind of micro device that can extract the firings of the neurons in your brain. And then you essentially send that information to a computer that has what we call a decoding algorithm that can perform this reinforcement learning process, but in silicon. And then it will translate all of that information into a control for either the computer cursor or a prosthetic arm or any number of devices that you can think about, right? And you know, there are many questions that really have to be addressed in order to kind of study this process, right? How the brain represents information, both rewarding and motor information, how that kind of information changes over time. And then on the engineering side, how does one develop algorithms to interpret it in real time and respond to it in the most efficient way possible? So we have not only biological questions to understand and neuro questions, but we have a whole lot of engineering questions that we also have to address in order to bring these kinds of things to reality.
Are the algorithms the same for women and men?
Very interesting question.
And children, I suppose, yeah.
So we haven't addressed gender differences and how the reward system and motor system encode information at this point in time. But I may be inclined to think that the coding may be a little different, right?
A little? a lot different, of course.
Yeah.
So I have another question, though. I'm still trying to imagine how this thing looks. How do you getting the connections between the machine and the brain? Is it like surgical implants, or is it just on the surface of the skull?
So how does this work? We're actually building surgical kinds of implants into the brain. So we make a little what we call craniotomy into the skull and put devices into the brain. But in this area of neuroprosthetics or brain-machine interfaces, there are a variety of both invasive and non-invasive kinds of approaches. Since we're very interested in understanding on the very elementary level of how the brain encodes information, we have to kind of go invasively in order to do that. But there are a few options that are out there that can blend both of them.
Are they commercially available?
There are a couple commercial, consumer devices that are attempting to build brain-machine kind of connections. But they don't operate anywhere near the level that we're describing here today. So this idea of reinforcement learning and taking reward and motor information in this kind of perception, action, reward cycle, there's nothing really that's out there right now. So this is the bleeding edge, what we're talking about.
Are you getting a lot of volunteers?
Yeah. So right now there's a large population of patients with either spinal cord injury or amputation or even things like ALS whose quality of life is severely diminished, right? And by interacting with some of these devices, they can regain a sense of normalcy. And there's a lot of work to really bring the technology to a point where it's extremely clinically viable. So, you know, a lot of us are working, as I said, in the bleeding edge to just show the proof of concept. But now in the next, I would say, 10 years, 5 to 10 years, the push is really to make them robust and clinically viable.
And maybe one last question. Do you see a lot of variability between individuals' ability to do these types of interaction? I mean, for example, the 3D movies, some people can handle it quite fine, others just can't. And I was wondering if certain people are genetically or for some other reasons more amenable to that type of machine-brain interactions.
Yeah, so that's a wonderful question. Everybody's brain, that at least I have observed in these kinds of contexts, they encode their intent and their rewards a little bit differently. And we actually, when we build these algorithms to decode the information, we tailor them to the specific individual. So yeah, there are variances in all of these things, but we do have the capability in order to tailor them. And you know, that's a great thing, right? To be able to engineer something that is specifically, you know, fit for that particular individual.
Can you make mine Mac OS?
Yeah, but you know, you bring up a very important question. Is about, you know, I would say that you are talking about Mac OS because of its robustness and its ease of use and things like that. And
just ease of use, yeah.
Right, those same kind of issues come up in these prosthetic devices, right? How does one build something that is easy to use and robust?
One sec, we're getting some noise. Are you in a lab?
Just one.
I don't know if that's coming from my end.
Oh, sorry.
So Andre looks like he.
Oh yeah, he had some interference. Okay, so we're back. So yeah. We're talking about the robustness of. Okay, I'll wait till the. Okay, so we're talking about the robustness of the signals.
Yeah. Yeah, robustness and ease of use. And if you know, we've gotten a lot of inspiration from biology, right? If you look at how have biological systems become very robust in these kinds of situations is that they learn over time, right? There's this process of reinforcement that you take a concept, you apply it in your environment, and then depending upon the outcome of those things, you may change your strategy for interacting with the environment. And we can take those same concepts and build them into engineered devices. And yeah, I would say that concept is very foreign in the hardware mindset right now. We typically think of building hardware or even software to do one thing and do one thing very well. But we're taking a completely different approach to that. We are looking at these from like an adaptive point of view, where you're, you know, probing, seeing the outcomes of those actions, and then using the information that you learned to help update it and make it even better. And that's really where this kind of interaction between reward and intent comes into play.
So you're taking it to the next level, though. Okay, so you've got a brain-machine interface capable of detecting a brain signal. You've had algorithms to interpret those brain signals, and you can then – now you're trying to find out how to send signals back into the brain with the proper – stimulation to create a positive or negative.
Well, not necessarily send information back into the brain yet, but maybe tap into those circuits of the brain that give you some evaluated feedback for how well that you are doing. And if we can get that piece of information to our devices will know kind of our satisfaction for using them, right? Right now, all of the devices that you or I would interact with, they have no idea for how satisfied we are with their interaction, how well they're performing. And because of that, they're kind of, for lack of a better word, they're kind of dumb in that situation, right? And this whole brain-machine interface idea using both motor and reward systems completely knocks down those barriers. And it says, yes, let's share the goal between user and computer. And if they can do that, possibly they could work in a more efficient or better way, a more robust way.
Or symbiotic way.
Or symbiotic way. So, you know, it's interesting we're using the idea symbiotic. Actually, the term symbiosis came out in the 1960s by a guy named Licklider, back when the field of cybernetics was being designed. And they also had this idea that by sharing something with a computer that you could do a little bit better. But back in the 60s, they really didn't have the technology to interface with the brain. And I think that that's what we do have today. We can interface with the brain in a variety of ways. We can go to a variety of the parts of the brain and extract that information and try to use it in a little bit better way, and maybe even deliver this idea of symbiosis.
Where do you see this being applied? In patients, in military, in sports, and improvement of human capabilities.
Yeah. So always immediately, these kinds of bleeding edge technologies, they can help the disabled individual, right? Whether it's again, a patient coming back from battle, some of our soldiers that are overseas, or if it's just a patient that was in a serious car injury, right? They are going to be the immediate beneficiaries from these kinds of things. But one thing that, you know, I've really been thinking about deeply is just this whole concept of how we interact with devices. If we think about it in a little bit deeper way, right, it may change the way that we interact with devices. And, you know, one may not necessarily need a brain implant in the long term, but if we could build devices that are a little bit more intelligent, that can cue into what some of our goals are, then maybe we can change the paradigm a little bit. And so it's going to be interesting to see how all of this unfolds. I mean, we have a tremendous amount to learn, right, both of how the brain works and how to engineer hardware. So there's a lot more things that have to be done before all of this becomes a reality. But I think that it is a reality that we can achieve at some point.
Well, you know, I asked Eric Kendall if there'd be a day we'd have USB in the back of our head. And whether
what did he say?
he said, "What?" He's a Nobel laureate. He said, right. "What?" Then
it
he said,
won't be USB,
"Oh yeah,
it'll be Thunderbolt."
You want Thunderbolt, right? Yeah. And he said, "Yeah, maybe in 100 years." But you know, then we had a follow up show with you, Justin, and you were saying go wireless. You know, so
yeah.
which is the absolute way to go. This
yeah.
is. Yeah, man, this is really, really neat stuff. And you combine it with some of the what they would call optogenetics. You know,
yes.
You've got reverse. You not only activate sort of electrical potentials. You know, you could go in and activate genes under yeah. control for perhaps someone who has a neurological disorder. You restore the expression of the correct genes to restore the health of the neurons. Or glial cells or whatnot, and then you go in and use a combination of optogenetic BMI chip, right? You can go back and forth and control the molecular biology of the cell and the physiology of the cell at the same time, all wirelessly.
Yeah, so I'm so glad that you brought up this idea that the optogenetic kind of techniques, because you said, you know, how do we deliver information back to the brain? And you know, I would say that that's one of the most difficult challenges trying to be addressed right now. We have no way of really writing in an efficient way the information back. And there are a few groups that are out there that are trying to use these optogenetic techniques that you can modulate very specific neurons in the brain. And, you know, we'll have to see. Only time will tell with that. But, yeah, we need a lot of creative ideas. So if anybody's out there that knows how to modulate neurons in an efficient and effective way, you know, that could be a nice piece of work.
You know, Justin, one of the reasons why we do these panel shows is to come up with some ideas as to where we want to take the show next. And I think if we could pull you on as a guest host on that, and you could, find out who you'd like to talk to really bridge that scientific gap of the brain machine interface and bring optogenetics into your lab. Because I think you'd do pretty well with it.
Yeah.
It would be really cool. So we could seek out some scientists working on that.
That'd sure. Really that would cool. be wonderful.
Are you feeling a little bit more sciencey, Andre?
Yep.
Andre.
I'd say we do yours first since it's a little bit heavier. And mine's almost like a dessert, so we'll do this one last.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, Justin. That was an I really encourage you to keep up your work. There was a question in the chat room. They want me to ask you about your DARPA work. Everybody's saying, ask him about his DARPA work. Can you talk about your DARPA work?
Yeah. So we can talk about that. And I'm glad somebody mentioned that. And, so let me take a step back. You know, we always hear from our president that innovation is something that will drive our country into the future. And that's a concept that I believe very heavily in. And it's going after really big science and big ideas that can really transform our culture and our technologies. I think that's something that we have to go after. And it's something that's been lost over the last maybe 10, 15, 20 years. We've become very conservative about these kinds of things. And one of the wonderful things of why I like working for DARPA is that they do go after these big science kinds of ideas, and they invest heavily in them, and they see the potential for going after, you know, things that could transform our lives. And you know, they have been, again, big supporters of these kinds of things that we're working on. And it's not only my lab that is involved in these kinds of things. There are many other labs working on neural interfaces that are trying to really advance technologies that can improve our lives.
It's amazing that you know, the Army grants are, and contracts tenders, or there's a serious element of civilian benefit to the civilian population, and that's a considerable element in the review process. And also the Army has and the Navy and the Air Force, they have these sort of strong community initiatives to tackle issues even like breast cancer. And so it's not all military medicine research is going to be towards improving the soldier capability or the strength of the future force. It's going to be also about taking care of that future force health, right, which improves the strength of the future force, but not as super individuals, you know. But so that's really it's a really good point, Justin, that, you know, it does translate.
Just one last thing. You got to go after tough problems, right? And if you don't go after tough problems, then you get stuck.
Well, the military are exposed to such dramatic environmental conditions that they suffer. And medicine is always to try and help the outcome for those people that are injured and whatnot, injured, diseased. So, it's good for people to go out there and try to apply for these Army grants and not necessarily think that, oh, they're just helping to make a better bomb. They're going out there to create a better cure. And we're working on brain swelling from brain trauma. So the Army is definitely a viable approach for financing our research. So how about I start the autoantigen discovery story? And Andre, feel free to feel sciencey and ask as many questions as you want, because I hope I don't hack this up. So this is I'm gonna present a paper from Benjamin Larman. He's the first author. Last author is Stephen Elledge, and I think this is from this came out of Cambridge, Mass. From Harvard, and I'll put the link to the paper. It was in Nature Biotechnology. One of the big technical problems that I've been thinking about is, say you have a patient with multiple sclerosis or an autoimmune disease where their body cannot distinguish between self and non-self. They have antibodies going to bind to proteins in their body that they shouldn't be attacking. And The big question, even in many conditions of multiple sclerosis, for example, is nobody knows what that protein is. If only you could find out what that protein their own antibodies are binding, you could develop a strategy to block that interaction rather than give a general immunosuppressant drug, right? Why do you want to turn off the immune system? You don't want to turn off the immune system. You just want to knock out that one protein interaction between the antibody and the what they call the antigen. The antigen is the protein that your antibodies stick to, targeting it for destruction by the immune system. So what people have done in the past is they've constructed what they call cDNA libraries. A cDNA library is a complementary DNA library. It's little strands of DNA in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of clones, right, individual segments. And they've expressed it in the genome of a phage. A phage is a little virus that attacks E. coli, right? And in doing so, it makes the protein. It takes the DNA, makes the protein in the simplest genetic construct possible, exposing the protein on the surface of the capsid of the phage virus. Then what you could do is take your cerebral spinal fluid where there's antibodies, or somebody has a neurological disorder that's an autoimmune disease, and then put the two together and find out which phage are binding to the antibodies. And you pull down the antibodies. There's biochemical techniques for pulling down antibodies, and then sequence the cDNA to find out what is the protein segment that these antibodies recognize. The problem with that is that cDNA libraries are made by taking somebody's RNA, translating it to complementary DNA, and the RNA is biased. It's biased for the cell type that you're using. It's biased for the genes that are highly expressed versus non-expressed. There's not a true representation of the entire human proteome. Does that make sense, Andre?
Yeah, and not to forget also that a lot of antigens in the human body are glycoproteins. So they're proteins, but they're modified with sugar residue or other modifications that are simply not reflected in an E. coli-based expression system. So right. Any antibody that recognizes that type of antigen is not going to be picked up by this method. That's the first one. The
right.
second
That's
one is...
Yeah,
the other problem is expressing cDNA from a mammalian source into E. coli is very inefficient. You're going to be lucky if you express 30% of the proteins.
Right. So this is going to be a problem with this paper as well, even though they have a new technique that eliminates the bias of difficult expression, the bias of, you know, in E. coli, the difficult expression or the difficult post-translational modifications. When protein is made in your body, as you said, it's got glycosylation, it's got phosphorylation, it has proteases that act on it. It has all kinds
sumoylation, ubiquitination. There's so many modifications beyond phosphorylation. It's quite impressive. Phosphorylation
right, right.
is the cute girl of the gang, but it's not the only one.
Right. As John Bergeron says, there's billions of proteins. So there's 24,000 open reading frames. Our human genome contains, they use 24,239 open reading frames. That means segments in our DNA that actually code for protein. They said, but out of 24,000, 23 were predicted to make protein. They looked perfect. Right. So, with all the possible post-translational modifications, everything that a cell can do to a protein, you've got billions of combinations. Okay, but that being said, okay, so what did this group do to help develop a technique that could take somebody's serum and identify how that serum interacts with proteins to identify where it's going wrong? Where is the antibody that's recognizing self when it shouldn't? So what they did is they went nuts. They used the build 35-1 of the human genome, 24,000 open reading frames. They divided each open reading frame being the part of the DNA that encodes for a gene, into 36 amino acid peptides, right? So for every amino acid, there's three codons. So they made small little segments of synthetic genes using a DNA synthesizer and had the DNA synthesizers hooked up to a computer and pumping out synthetic genes that they encoded for 36 amino acid proteins. And they overlapped them by 7 residues, so the 36, then 36, and 36, but they were overlapping slightly. Then 30, it's hard to do it in reverse. But so the overlapping by 7 amino acids. So these little segments of protein were made in a way that could cover the entire proteome with overlap of where an antibody typically recognizes a protein, which in a linear stretch is roughly about 7 amino acids. Okay, so they made 413,000 constructs and basically 413,000 peptides spanning the entire coding region of the human genome. I could go into some detail here. They used releasable DNA microarrays, 19 pools of 22,000 oligos. None of that really makes any sense to me, although those like Andre, it's, of course. Right? Okay, so...
some kind of deconvolution is probably being involved in the sense that they're not individual pools, but it could be like, depending on which peptides they put into which wells, depending on which wells light up, you're able to calculate, okay, the only this peptide would give you exactly this pattern of binding. That's one possibility that how they did that.
Yeah, well, that's why you can do this kind of big science. So the idea is now you have a library of phage. These are the little E. coli viruses, right? But that have a little segment. Each one has a little segment of the human proteome, has a little human in it, right? And that if you pool, take your test tube and you put virus made from these 413,000 different human constructs, you're going to have a whole human basically in a test tube based on the expression of on the viral capsid, so that you've got 413,000.
Well, a whole human that's been put into a blender for a very, very long time, but yes.
Into a blender of 36 amino acids, right? Which is fantastic. And you've got an even representation. They did this. Now they're using high-throughput sequencing, and they were able to – you can go in and then sequence a sample of this, and they found that they had actual 92% coverage of expected clones, right? More importantly, 78% of the library was within a tenfold abundance. So now you had the human proteome evenly spread out – well, of course, in a nanodrop, but evenly spread out and uniform. So now with this in hand, all you do is take the person's cerebral spinal fluid if they have neurological disorder – and take the antibodies, mix them with this the E. coli virus expressing the human proteome, and if there's going to be an interaction between the antibodies and the proteome in the phage, you're going to be able to purify it biochemically. There's a reagent called protein A, and there's another one called protein G, and the team optimized these washing conditions. These are little beads. They actually weigh. They have some weight to them. And they bind antibodies. So you've got your cerebral spinal fluid with antibodies. You've got your library. You add your protein A, protein G, and you centrifuge it out. You wash. The beads will fall to the bottom. You add some buffer. You resuspend it. You spin it down again. And you're basically washing away everything that's nonspecific. And then
is there several cycles of purification, amplifications of viruses? Because this is where phages are very powerful. Initially, you have billions and billions of phages representing the entire human proteome. But these interactions with DNA, they're not extremely specific, especially if you're looking for binding to a linear sequence. But where it gets powerful is that you do a purification once, you purify some of the phages. Then you put phages in E. coli, and they make baby phages of the same genomes. They make even more, and you purify several cycles like that. And essentially what you do is you enrich in the phages that will bind to these antibodies.
Well, that's a very good question. They did subjected enriched phage populations, okay, because you enrich the phage that are cross-reacting to the human patient's antibodies, and they did PCR amplification and deep sequencing DNA analysis. Does that make sense? So they did PCR amplification. And so that's pretty wild. Now you have a technique that can give you the best possible coverage of the genome and find out what proteins are actually interacting with that person's immune system. Now, I'm bringing this story up because, you know, there's a lot of people out there, and you may know some with diseases where the antigen isn't known. And I'm faced with this situation, and I'm trying to, like, how we're going to go about correcting this. And if you had an antibody and you know what that antibody is recognizing and you already know it down to 36 amino acids, all you simply have to do now is give that person an injection of that peptide. You make the peptide in a robot, in a peptide-making robot. The person who invented that machine, by the way, Lee Hood, has been on the show twice. So you get his machine. He's making the... you make the peptide and you inject them, and now you're competing the antibodies binding to the protein in their neurological system, and you're killing that binding. You don't have to stop the whole immune system. You just have to stop that single antibody. So this technique has now opened the door, while it has problems, has opened the door to neurological disorders, to type 1 diabetes, to lupus, you know, to a whole slew of diseases. Rheumatoid arthritis is a major, major medical problem, unmet medical need. So this is really neat. Now, do you have a question, Andre?
Well, there's a couple of limitations into that methods that have to be taken into account. And we had a big project where we were trying to make hundreds of monoclonal antibodies against dozens and dozens of cancer-related proteins. And initially, our first run through for this project was to use peptides as the antigens. And we were very good at making anti-peptide monoclonals antibody. The problem is they would rarely recognize the folded full-length proteins to which the peptides were derived. So the methods will work fantastic for these antibodies that whose antigen is just a linear sequence of peptides, but there's a lot of antibodies out there that will recognize, for example, their epitope is like two branches, two different branches of the polypeptides that are together in the three-dimensional structure, but they're not together in the linear structure. So they will never get picked up in a strategy such as that one. That's the first limitation. The other limitation is any antibodies that recognize modified proteins, as we said in the beginning, whether it's glycosylation or other modifications, it's not going to get picked up as well. So it's the kind of strategy that's really great. It'll give you a positive result, maybe very informative to identify what the potential target of these antibody is. The profile themselves may be tremendously interesting. I mean, it almost gives you like a very complex picture of what that person's immune system is. So I can see a lot of potential there. But I would not be surprised if there's a lot of cases where it simply won't work because even though you have billions of different phage sequences, the diversity is just not complex enough.
What if you were to make the full-length open reading frames and use an expression system such as insect expression system, baculovirus, where you have a human mimetic cell line that has all the mammalian cellular modifications?
That could work.
Would it boost your pool, right? Well, this is version one.
It's doing this in high throughput, but I mean, you never know how smart people can figure out things. First, you do it in a small scale, in a small sequence, and then pretty soon you have a much better system. I won't say maybe baculo, but there are probably viral systems out there that can be co-opted into making longer sequences that would be more better antigens.
Well, I have to say that my wife cloned all the genes of the human, or most of them, of the human Orpheum. As a project for Invitrogen to make the protein microarrays. The issue with that is that it becomes extremely expensive and difficult to do in every lab, I suppose. There might be other reasons where it might actually be more useful. And you take the person's cerebral spinal fluid, run it on a microarray with the entire human proteome expressed in full-length proteins. And wow, but that might be doable, but at least let me give you an example of how it worked. So they didn't just set it up. They tried it, and what they did is they took patients with something called paraneoplastic neurological syndromes. Now, paraneoplastic neurological syndromes at the interface of autoimmunity disease, right, and cancer. Whereas, if you have cancer, your body might develop an immunity to it, because there's new proteins and proteins in a different abundance, something that might have been very rare and now is high abundance, that is now made. You develop an immunity to it, and then now you have an immunity to it. You have antibodies. They go and attack the parts of the body where that protein was originally found. So the cancer cells are kind of screwed up that way. Now, and there's one, the paraneoplastic neurological syndromes are that exact case where you have a cancer. You develop an immunity towards that cancer, great. That's a good thing. But then now you have an autoimmune disease where you've got neurological disorders because there's a crosstalk between your immunity now. You've got new antibodies and you're starting to have autoimmune disease.
Well, the potential for immune profiling is kind of staggeringly cool. I mean, imagine if you could run a test like this. And depending on which profiles you obtain, you might be able to say, oh, suddenly you're getting cancer markers for this type of cancer into your immune system. You may not even know that you have a certain tumor in your body, but your immune system does. And depending on the profile you're getting, you might be able to link it to different pathologies. It has a lot of potentials beyond simply autoimmune diseases.
Yeah, this is going to be one program in the tricorder. So they took patient A, who was a 63-year-old female who had a non-small cell lung cancer and found to have PND, okay, so paraneoplastic neurological syndrome. But she did a panel of antibodies. They know there's certain antigens already. They've discovered a few, and one of them is called NOVA, neuro-oncological ventral antigen. That's the name of it, called NOVA. Right, so she has a protein in her body that's getting attacked by her immune system, and they know it's NOVA. So what they did is they tested this system to see if it would pull out NOVA, and it did actually pull out NOVA. They had also pulled out SAPK4, which was a positive control peptide, which they threw into the sample. But it also pulled out six other candidate autoantigens. So this person's immune system wasn't just attacking NOVA1, but it was attacking potentially others. They tested three. And how did they test the three? Well, they actually took a mammalian cell line,
They took the genes that were identified, expressed them, and then tested them by immunoblotting, which means they used the cerebral spinal fluid of the patient and looked to see if there was a cross reaction to those autoantigens. And one of them, TGIF2LX, you got to love biotech, TGFB induced factor homeobox 2 like X-linked. So it was confirmed as a novel autoantigen for PND, for paraneoplastic neurological syndrome. So they identified a new potential autoimmune autoantigen. So a protein that the body recognizes as self, as non-self when it's supposed to be self. Okay, so that's pretty cool. They did find the one they were expecting, and they found a new one. Well, they went to patient B, 59-year-old female with a dysthyria, ataxia, head tibitation. I'm not an MD. Muscular rigidity, but when her serum was tested against the panel of paraneoplastic antibody and for antibodies, they found it was negative. So, they took the sample, the serum from patient B, and mixed it with their library of phage expressing the human proteome, and they found three autoantigens. One of them was, guess what? TGIF2LX. So they confirmed in a second patient that the new autoantigen that they found in patient A was actually a neuroantigen in patient B. They also found cancer testis antigen 2 and glutamate decarboxylase 2. So they found three, and they verified them, and that person had antibodies against these three autoantigens. So now you have a potential methodology for treating this patient. But okay, so next step. Patient C. This patient developed melanoma and an unusual horizontal gaze palsy, right? They tested this person. They found using the system, they took their serum, mixed it in with the library of phage, and identified, two family members of the TRIM family of proteins. So two TRIM proteins, TRIM67, which is highly expressed in melanoma, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. Here's an antigen in a cancer cell, TRIM67, and they found TRIM9, which is a brain-specific E3 ubiquitin ligase. So it's a brain protein involved in the cascade of degradation of proteins, and that's important in cell homeostasis and a lot of functions. But that being said, they found TRIM67, but a highly related family member called TRIM9. And this suggests that there's potential crosstalk of immunity, whereas you might have an autoimmune disease that recognizes a cancer cell, it might then go recognize a different protein, but a family member in a different tissue. So this, overall, the work of Benjamin Larman and Zhenmin Zhao, Lars Laserson, Lee Chikia, Martinez, Kikak. I missed it. George Church is on this paper, for God's sakes.
There you go.
Santosh, that's a name that rings a bell.
He's been on the show a number of times. He's fantastic.
Exactly.
And, he's probably involved in some of the sequencing elements because they're at Harvard and they're sequencing. He's very, very developed incredible approaches. He was the individual I was talking about who put the who's planning on putting a DNA sequencer on Mars. So that's kind of weird.
So what I would do with this, if I would be the one running that, like I was saying, that has a lot of potential for almost general diagnostic purposes, because now you're getting markers for cancer from human genes. But it's very simple to take that library of human proteins and add on proteins from, let's say, every known human pathogen or bacteria or viruses that occasionally inhabit our system. And then depending on the profile that you get, you might be able to diagnose a lot of things. Essentially, you're asking your immune system, what is worrying you right now? And the immune system, well, that one is annoying, that one I'm binding to. And depending on what proteins you get, you might be able to identify pathologies. So and considering how fast next-gen sequencing technologies is going, this is essentially an assay that can be done very, very quickly. You could probably get plasma or cerebral spinal fluid in one day, do the binding assay in an hour or two, especially with magnetic beads, then do the PCR in an hour, send it off to sequencing. 2 hours later, you got the profiles out. That has I hope they patented it because that has tremendous potential.
You're talking like Agent Scully in the X-Files. You know, she was always able to sequence DNA back in the 90s in 2 hours, right? You do the Southern blots in like an hour to determine whether or not she was alien, and she did it 2 hours. It takes overnight to do a Southern blot.
Well, don't get me started when they were showing her doing a Southern blot. She was putting the nucleotides directly into the Southern solution because they were like they were red dyed. So you would say, wait a minute, you're supposed to do labeling before putting it in there. Anyway, details.
Yeah, but you know, it's fine. It was a fun show. But hey, let's, you know, this is totally geeking out here. So it introduces, one, a new methodology for rapid diagnosis of autoimmune disorders. Two, it brings potential therapeutics to the forefront right away. So, okay, you make the peptide. The peptide's not fully folded. Maybe you do need a fully formed protein. Well, you can make that fully formed protein. And if somebody asked me to make a therapeutic protein, it would take me probably about 6 weeks, and I could make grams of the protein in the lab. It would cost maybe $100,000, but if it extends that person's lifespan by 20 years, you know, it would be tremendous. And it would be very, very non-toxic to make proteins. It would be the opposite of non-toxic. It would be extremely beneficial if you could titer out that person's autoimmune antibodies. So that's why I thought this was a fun story. And, you know, I'll put a link up again to as I said before, into the show notes. If somebody wants to go and find the paper, they can find it. It's a great example of, you know, non-traditional drug discovery, non-traditional molecular medicine. You know, it's a very inspiring story. Justin, his battery is dying, so he's gonna disconnect probably and fetch a connector. We biotechnologists aren't necessarily the most computer, but he is. Do you have your battery back?
No, I haven't hooked it up yet. I was hanging in there to the last possible minute. I'll find a power cord, huh?
All right, cool. So, Andre, I think we're doing okay on time. So how about you you describe the story that you picked for us?
All right. So the story I picked up is from Nature, not one of the small Nature, the big Nature journal. And essentially it's a team led by Matthias Selbach from the Max Delbruck Center for Molecular Medicine. So that's in Berlin, Germany. And they essentially found the perfect way of getting a Nature paper, which is you find a very simple question that will interest pretty much every biologist that there is, and you answer it in the most elegant way possible. So the question that they're asking is, how do you get different protein levels inside a cell? And the way you determine that, there's four processes that determine how much protein is inside a cell. You get the rate of transcription, the rate of messenger RNA degradation, how fast are the messenger RNAs translated, and how fast is the protein degraded. And there's been a lot of studies comparing messenger RNA and protein levels done to date. That's always been, especially when a lot of us doing microarray work, and people are saying, well, are the messenger RNA profiles have anything relevant to do to the protein levels inside the cell? So there's been a lot of studies out there comparing messenger RNA to protein levels, but they've always had a very serious limitation, mostly because of technical challenges in large-scale protein identification and quantification. It's fairly easy to do a microarray, but when you deal with protein quantification in a large scale, you're dealing with proteomics, and because proteins are so much more complex than messenger RNA, it's a lot more difficult. And most of the time, protein levels were measured in one experiment compared to messenger RNA in a different experiment, sometimes even at a different time in a different lab. And also, it's very difficult when you do, for example, a microarray experiment. And that's something I say all the time when I give classes on microarrays. You are not measuring gene expression. You're measuring messenger RNA levels, which are the combined effect of mRNA transcription and mRNA degradation. So the analysis of all of this was always a little bit difficult. Some of the best studies out there actually use artificial fusion proteins. They got some interesting correlations. But even then, you're not talking about the real proteins because now they're tagged with something very stable, usually some form of GFP. So that can affect protein stability. The gold standard for measuring intracellular protein intracellular molecule dynamics in a cell has always been pulse labeling. So in a pulse labeling experiment, what you're doing is you have your cells growing in a media that doesn't have anything labeled. In the old days, it was radioactivity. You would suddenly throw in C14. In the old days, it would be radioactivity carbon-14 or P32 or S35. Yeah. You would go from a non-radioactive media to a radioactive media. So now all of the new molecule being synthesized would incorporate that radioactive marker. Then you would take the cells and put them into a non-labeled media. So now you have a pulse of proteins or biomolecules that have been labeled during a certain length of time. And then over time, they're going to essentially, you see the production of these labeled molecules. And then once you transfer into a non-labeled media, you're going to see their degradation. And you're able
it's
to
like
make
a duck
calculations.
Race, by the way.
Sorry?
Dave Thomas on his episode of Futures in Biotech, he described it as a duck race. You take a bunch of little duckies and you pop them into a river and you follow them going through the river.
Yeah, you can tell somebody's living in the West Island. So in proteins, the way you do this now is you don't use radioactivity. What you can use is you can use slight variants of certain amino acids that have different number of neutrons into their atoms. So there's a slightly different molecular weight that can be detected by mass spectrometry. So the method's name is called stable isotope labeling by amino acids in cell culture, or SILAC. Alternatively, you can also label messenger RNA by a nucleoside analog called 4-thiouridine, 4-STU, that can be independently purified from non-4-STU labeled RNA. So what this group did is they took a mouse cell line, NIH3T3, which is a very well-characterized fibroblastic cell line, and they simultaneously labeled it by SILAC or by 4-STU. Quantify the proteins by mass spectrometry, or for the RNA, they've purified three populations of RNA using separation of ribosome-bound or non-ribosome-bound RNA. So they had pre-existing RNA, newly synthesized RNA, as well as total RNA without separation. Then they used Solexa sequencing to see which RNA is in which population. So now they're able to really measure protein levels, changes in labeled proteins, and change in labeled RNA over time in the same cell line. So, and they brought out a lot of very interesting numbers, which I have to admit, I had no idea what these numbers would be. For example, they found out that on average, proteins are 5 times more stable than messenger RNA. And they span a much bigger dynamic range in abundance. That part, we already knew that. One thing that was notable is they saw no correlation whatsoever between protein and messenger RNA half-lives. So the degradation of proteins, degradation of RNA, they're usually not linked. They're totally independent mechanisms. Levels of proteins span approximately 5 orders of magnitude. That, like I said, it's very large. That's actually a big problem in proteomics. The wide diversity and protein abundance. But when they compared in a log-log graph the abundance of each proteins being synthesized to the abundance of their messenger RNA, they actually had a pretty good correlation. The R2 square score was 0.41. So at least you can tell that about 40% of protein abundance is controlled by how much messenger RNA for that protein is present. They tested that reproducibility by doing the same experiment in another cell line, a human cell line, so they're pretty confident about their number. And they also used the information they have to build a computer model to calculate average synthesis rate of messenger RNA and proteins for thousands of different genes. So this is where it gets really, really cool. So for example, so here's a little survey. So Julian, you're back online?
Justin?
Justin? He was online, but I'm not sure if he managed to get back on. So it's going to be a survey of one. Okay. It may be the chat room. What do you think is the median rate of transcription per hour on average in the humans in a mammalian cell?
Number of genes that are transcribed from DNA to protein.
For each gene, how many messenger RNA is being transcribed per gene per hour on average?
How many proteins are median, made, basically? Yeah.
No, not proteins. We're right now just doing the messenger RNA.
But transcribed? Oh, no, not translated. Sorry.
Transcribed. How many messenger RNA do you think we make per gene?
Per gene or per cell?
Yes, per gene. In one gene in a cell.
Depends on the gene if it has a strong
promoter.
Yes,
what's the median number?
The median number, of course, three.
You said three? Well, that's not bad. The actual number is three.
I'm kidding. I don't know. Maybe 500-600.
No, two.
I was right with the three?
Yes. I saw that number and I went like, wow, that is really, really small.
So a gene...
A gene will be on average transcribed twice per hour.
Is that because we have a lot of genes and that biases the statistics, or is it?
Well, I have the distribution in figure three in the paper, and very, very few genes are as much as 10 messenger RNA per hour, and almost none of them have 100 messenger RNA per hour. So I was quite.
That's amazing.
I thought that number would be higher, to be quite frank.
I was just kidding.
Yeah.
I was answering my 5-year-old's
okay.
Answer.
So now we have each messenger RNA then is translated. So how many translation events do you think occurs per hour per messenger RNA?
Okay, Median number. Describe that to the audience here. My dad might be listening.
So essentially you have a messenger RNA molecule. You're going to have ribosomes bound on it. They're going to translate this into a protein.
Copy it into a protein, right. How many times does that zipper action happen? Because it's like a zipper. As long as zipper attaches amino acids, you get a protein made.
How many times per hour? Median.
Two. I don't know.
No. 40.
Maybe more. You want to use it more. How much? Did you say 30?
They said about 40 proteins per messenger RNA per hour. But in this case, the distribution is much, much broader. You can get as much based on the distribution. You can get some of the highest one as 10 to the 4 proteins per messenger RNA per hour. That's the high range. But the median is 40 proteins per messenger RNA per hour. Some proteins involved in translational regulation, EIF4, Fragile X syndrome related protein, FRX2, tubulin, they have extremely low rate constant. They're actually translationally repressed, but they really see different translation efficiencies in different genes. So it's quite fascinating. So based on all these numbers, as I said, about 40% of variance in protein levels is explained by messenger RNA levels. And that's a lot more than what people thought. So for people like me who do a lot of array data, array experiment, that's a good thing. Because essentially we can say, yeah, well, we're seeing expression profile, transcript profiles for a lot of genes. And that is 40% correlated to the ultimate proteins level in the end. And they saw that in two cell lines.
That's amazing. One sec before you go on. Justin is back online. His computer is charged. It's charging. So if you could please pull him back. All
okay,
right. So now you actually have a sense, right? Of you can actually visualize in your mind the general trends of RNA being made into protein and how much RNA is being made off the DNA.
Yes. Off the gene. And the other thing that they did was they tried to contribute what is the contribution of degradation to protein levels, whether it's messenger RNA degradation or protein degradations. And surprisingly, it's a very small contribution. Degradation rates they found were generally very constant, at least in their one cellular model. But there were proteins that are known to have variations in degradation rates. But what they did after that is they divided all of their proteins into four categories. So you had unstable mRNAs but stable proteins, stable mRNA, stable protein, unstable mRNA, unstable protein, and stable mRNA, unstable protein. And they look for functional differences between the proteins in these four categories. And they found very different types of proteins in these four categories. So for example, genes with stable messenger RNA and stable proteins, they're greatly enriched in They call them constitutive cellular processes like translation, respiration, and central metabolism like glycolysis, ribosomal protein, TCA cycle proteins. I wouldn't call that constitutive genes because, I mean, part of my work is to figure out how these genes are modulated under different growth conditions. So I won't call them constitutive, but they do represent a huge number, a huge proportion of the energy that's being used in protein synthesis.
Okay, so basically stable RNA, stable protein is basically housekeeping biological processes that are universal to all cells, probably.
Exactly. Now you're going to have the unstable mRNA, but...
stable protein.
Stable protein, you have... wait a second. Okay, this is unstable mRNA, unstable proteins. You have a lot of transcription factor, signaling gene, chromatin modifying enzymes, and cell cycle specific proteins. So these are essentially the signal transduction molecules whose level needs to change very quickly.
They always say kill the messenger, right? So when they say kill the messenger, it could be killing the messenger RNA and killing the proteins that are messenger information carriers.
Exactly. Okay. So you now have a group of genes with stable proteins but unstable mRNA. That's mostly related to actually RNA processing, strangely enough. Okay. And finally, you have stable mRNA and unstable proteins. That's extracellular and secreted proteins. So it's known a lot of secreted proteins have short cellular half-life.
Sure.
And there's a lot of proteins involved in cellular homeostasis, defense response, and proteolysis. But what's really cool about this paper, it's not just knowing what contributes to the final protein levels into a cell, is now they have a huge data set of information on protein abundance and half-life. So a lot of people who do mathematical models of processes in cells, they need to know that information. They need to know how much of my enzyme is present in the average cell, how fast is it being produced, and how fast is it being degraded. And very often these are parameters that have to be determined experimentally. If you have four or five proteins, that's okay. If you're trying to model a multi-protein system, it's very difficult. But at least now you have numbers that – starting parameter numbers to know, okay, I have the enzymatic information on my enzyme, and I know I have that about this number of enzymes per cell, at least in this cell line for the enzyme I'm trying to model. This is going to be tremendously useful for systems biologists.
You know, kidding, especially if you're Craig Venner and you want to build an artificial creature and you're looking at the complexity of 24,000 open reading frames and a billion post-translational.
Well, they didn't get all 24,000. They got data on about 5,000, 6,000 proteins.
It's amazing.
So it's a good start, but it's not perfect yet. But it's going to be a tremendously useful data set.
And the funny thing is, I would have expected this to be known, right? And then this kind of paper that says, wait a minute, guys, you know, you don't know anything.
You got into nature. You essentially, it's something that interests a lot of people. And people are saying like, oh, why didn't I think of that? I could have had a Nature paper. Because the technologies that they were using were not – I mean, they weren't the ones – I don't think they were the one that invented SELECT labeling and the RNA labeling. They just decided to apply it to something very basic but very, very important. And as long as their statistics are well done, they're gone. This is Conan, by the way.
Oh, hey, Conan. So the you look at a protein like cystic fibrosis, right, the CFTR channel. I think, 75% of the CFTR channel is degraded in the human cell, in the epithelial cells, those lining of your lungs and lining of your nasal passage and gut. So the chloride channel is a very, very unstable protein. The mutated form, the delta F508, phenylalanine residue 508 mutation, it actually 99% of it's degraded. Right. So understanding the stability of a protein in a cell and possibly how it's translated can give you a really, really good indication of the molecular mechanism of a disease. And now if you're going with a whole entire genome, if you can, I mean, this is the first phase of this project. I think it'll give us some insight into some of the mechanisms of disease or a better understanding of the biology, which I thought we already knew. But clearly this study was
is fantastic at pointing out our ignorance, right? Which is amazing. That's cool. Very good choice, Andre. Is Justin back?
I'm back. I'm
this
here.
This is a summer
back
show.
Back in black, as they say.
Show. Hey, cool. And are you in the same room? There's no brain posters in the back.
Yeah, I'm in a different room now. I had to find some power.
That's cool. Well, I like the idea of having some brain images in the back. Hey, so yeah. I'm going to thank you both for coming on. These are some really fun scientific stories. In part, one thing I really appreciated about this episode was it was an episode for us, right? And I hope that people can appreciate some of the stories that we picked. You know, sometimes you got to, you know, see what's interesting to you and then see if that can stick on the wall of the greater audience. So this is a really good time to do it. I think we should, there's some follow-ups here, Andre and Justin. I think we can possibly contact the group that did the global expression mammalian gene expression control paper, and we could seek them out and potentially do a show on this and get their views on how and what, and get them to give examples and describe some of the experiments that they did. Also, for the bridging optogenetics with brain machine interfaces. That would be a really great line of shows. We've just finished a long series of shows on aging, interviewing folks from the Buck Institute. And I think the next step is to get into brain-machine interfaces with optogenetic. I think that would be a really, really fun interface there to go.
Yeah, optogenetics sounds fun. And I have a few people that maybe we can give a call.
Very cool. All right. Without further ado, I'd like to thank... Our guests, our panelists, Andre Nantel, Senior Research Officer at the Biotechnology Research Institute, Microarray Lab, National Research Council of Canada. He's also an adjunct professor at McGill University in the Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology. Thank you, Andre, for coming on.
Thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure.
And we also have the Director of the Neuroprosthetics Research Group, Associate Professor, Department of Biomedical Engineering at the University of Miami. We have Dr. Justin Sanchez.
Mark, thanks so much for having me on. And just for all the viewers out there, you know, it's about having fun with science. So go out and do something great with it. And, you know, there are lots of horizons that can be found.
Let's tell them, yeah, go out and save a million lives and help those million that are, you know, disabled and give them a new life. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff you can do, and you can actually make a difference. You know, not just one at a time, but hundreds of thousands, if not millions at a time. I'd also like to thank Burke McQuinn for handling the audio and video boards and recordings today. It was a true challenge, and he's been a gentleman about it. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible. Lisa Laporte, Lisa Kenzel, Frederic Louis, Eileen Rivera, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Slanina, Jeff Stewart, Jason Howell, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. I've got to find out everybody works there. I've got to go visit the cottage. Well,
wait till they have the new one.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to thank Phil Pelzino and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If anybody has any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at Mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv or on Twitter at MARCPLLETIER. It's at Mark Pelletier. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.